It's a pretty common sight when you see groups of young people these days. They all have electronic devices in their hands, and they're all looking down at them, not at each other. But understand, they are communicating and interacting with other people, just not necessarily the ones physically nearby. Those of us who did not grow up with ubiquitous electronics and web connections have a few things to learn about digital natives. Devorah Heitner gives us the lessons in her book, Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Devorah Heitner is the founder and director of Raising Digital Natives, dedicated to assisting parents and schools so they can help kids navigate the world of digital connectedness. Aside from two books, she has developed a school curriculum to help kids use screens responsibly. Dr. Heitner, thanks for joining us. Well, many people have concerns, but you seem rather optimistic about what kids can do with digital devices.
I am. I think there's a lot of advantages for kids growing up in the digital age and a lot of opportunities. That said, they definitely need our mentorship to be able to harness what's positive and also navigate the issues that are more stressful.
So you're raising your own digital native, I understand. How old is your child, and how early did you start with the gadgets?
Nearly eight, and the gadgets really begin before they have any of their own, right? They're interested in our phones. I think if you're around any toddlers or preschoolers, they're very interested in our devices. And so it really starts with how are we modeling the use of our devices and what kind of insights are we sharing with them? What kind of habits are we modeling? But their fascination begins before they even, you know, can use a device personally. They just see how excited we are about them. And
Do we even bother to buy kids toy cell phones anymore? It seems like they get them pretty young.
That's true. I think a lot of parents are using their phones selectively as toys, but they also sometimes are giving kids old phones that are discarded that may have capabilities they're still not thinking about. But yeah, the idea of a fake phone or a little plastic phone that you would dial or something does seem like a very dated toy now.
It's kind of quaint. How much of a challenge do you find it to keep up with both the technology and the digital world that it accesses?
It is challenging. The most important thing we can do is really talk with other parents and also interrogate our kids, you know, curiosity a little bit, not interrogate them, like shake them down,
right.
Interrogate their curiosity a little bit. And a lot of times kids want something that they've heard about, or they're very interested in a kind of content, like maybe a certain YouTuber that they've heard about. And we want to know what they think is cool about it. What do they think is fascinating? What do they think is funny? And we also have to remember their taste is going to be different than our taste. And that was true for us. I mean, the kind of television most of us watched as children, or you know, books we were interested in, some of us don't hold those same interests throughout our lives. So we have to kind of recognize that our kids are going to be into different things than we are. That said, I think we want to understand, for example, if they're super excited about Minecraft, what is it about Minecraft that's fun? And is there a way that they can actually lead us into a deeper understanding by showing us the game, showing us the different modes, showing us some of the things that they've built in the game? And I think that's one of the most helpful things we can do as parents is get really curious about what our kids are actually doing on there.
You know, Minecraft is a good place to talk about, because when we had foster kids in the house, that was one of the games they were really interested in. And it was fun to watch them because it is a constructive process. They weren't shooting people on screen. But still, I remember getting boggled by the complexity of it and all the different tools, and yet how quickly the kids were able to figure everything out.
Absolutely. And it is very intuitive for them. I mean, kids can be quite naive about some digital things, like the question of fake news, for example, or how well they evaluate some of the things that they read. But their ability to assimilate games and learn to use apps, or even just learn to navigate it, especially in a tablet or smartphone, which you don't even need to be able to read to use a touch screen. So you see very young kids pretty adroitly, you know, getting around in these spaces. And so there's a way that it can feel to parents who may have taken some time. Like, I know it took me some time to adjust to tablet usage. I'm a very intrepid laptop user. And even to this day, I'm still more comfortable in a laptop environment than I am really. I'm not one of those people who can manage my whole life from my smartphone or a tablet. But I see how well kids do it. It's very easy to think, oh, they're really good at this. They don't need us. But they do need us. There's so many interactions and issues that can come up that they absolutely need adult guidance.
And in fact, that's an early warning in the book, is just because the kids are fluent in technology doesn't mean they really know what they're getting into.
Absolutely. They really don't. And especially when it comes to navigating their relationships. I mean, to come back to the Minecraft example, kids can play Minecraft and be really great at building and be constructive. And as you say, it's really quite a well-designed game. There's a lot to learn. It offers think, a lot of great challenges. But when it comes to what do you do if your, you know, foster sibling or friend on the server or someone you don't even know destroys your building, or what do you do if someone uses nasty language with you on a public server or something else? Kids have no clue what to do in those situations.
So you say that kids need help even if they and you don't think they need it. So what's the nutshell of what the approach should be here?
I definitely would offer them mentorship about things like conflict resolution. You know, if you're playing a game with a friend and they quit in rage, or if you're group texting, which is a very common preoccupation for upper elementary and middle school kids who get on their own phones or even get on other people's devices, is group texting. A lot of interpersonal issues can come up. And so where they really need help is resolving those interpersonal issues, whether it's conflict or navigating gossip or what to do if they're being recruited into someone else's conflict, those kinds of issues.
A lot to talk about here for sure, and we will talk about it with Devorah Heitner, PhD. She is the founder of Raising Digital Natives and the author of the book Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you. Again, a lot to talk about in this subject area, so feel free to join us on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on The Exchange with Devorah Heitner and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Devorah Heitner, PhD, the founder of Raising Digital Natives, which is exactly what it's all about, helping raise kids in a world in which they have grown up with electronics and constant web connectedness. Remember how as we got older, we got used to hearing the sound of the modem connecting through the dial-up? Yeah, that seems like a very, very, very long time ago. Devorah Heitner's book is called Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Devorah, you mark a good pathway in time here from when we had the first central computer in the house to decentralizing a bit with laptops, and now I have smartphones. So we've really kind of flung devices and people all over our homes by this point, haven't we?
Absolutely, and it's smart to take some of that control back by at least planning where do these devices, you know, sleep at night? Are they going to sleep with us? Are we all going to snuggle up with our smartphones? And we might think it's great as adults, but do we want our teenagers doing it?
Well, that's actually a big one, I understand, for a lot of parents, because kids do tend to, like, you know, they roll over 2 in the morning and, hey, I'm awake, what are you doing? Bing, bing, and they'll text their friends.
Absolutely, and it really disturbs their sleep. And if we can do one thing for teenagers, it's help them get enough sleep. That's a really great, important developmental issue to be concerned about. And it's tough to get sleep when your phone is pinging you all night long with the latest or just updating, you know, with other people's texts. So parents are often surprised if they do keep their kids' phones in their own room overnight, just how much is going on in the wee hours.
Oh, is the technology still new enough, though, that there are great variations in screen time rules by family?
It's tremendous, and I think one of the most unfortunate issues is a lot of us have been socialized to feel guilty about screen time, so we don't communicate with other parents the way we do about other things. I mean, it's become more common in the culture, I think, to be open with other parents about the parenting challenges that we face and the struggles we might face with lots of transitions, the transition to school, teaching kids to be more independent, struggles over chores, struggles between siblings. Those are pretty out there, but screen time is one of those things that parents often feel guilty about, and it makes us reluctant to go to other parents and say, well, my kids love Minecraft, and I think it's pretty great, but how many hours are you letting your kids play, and what do you do if they turn into kind of monsters when they're done, or how do you navigate this? I think because so many of us feel a little bit guilty that we're letting our kids use technology at all, or we feel like maybe this marks us as a bad parent, or we feel bad that we've let them use an app that we don't know that much about, so we don't want to go to another parent and admit, hey, I let my kids download this app, and I actually have no clue what it does. Can you tell me? But it's actually a great thing to do. And one of the most productive things we can do is be more open with other families and get some advice, especially if you know someone with kids who are a bit older than your own kids, even a year or two, and maybe they're going to have experienced things like the first phone or first email account or first experience playing online games on a public server before your child gets there. That's the ideal person to go to and talk about it, because if we don't, then we're all flying blind and we don't need to be.
So you mentioned 8 for your own child, and is that your recommended age for everybody else as well?
8 for what?
For starting with devices.
Oh, I wouldn't. My child still doesn't have his own devices, but he's been able to access a family-owned tablet since he was 4 or 5, and we used it even before that to play music for him, but he didn't really use apps until he was 4. We use an iPad in our family. That's mm-hmm. That's one of our... And it's a shared device, but it really belongs to Mama and Papa, so he has to ask. Uh-huh. He doesn't have his own. And I don't see him needing his own device for a while. When we start doing more gaming, he'll do that on a shared family device. So I think 8 is a good time to start asking kids permission before we share their picture on social media, but that's still more our social media. You know, when a lot of adults my age and people with kids are using Facebook, that's sort of the predominant social media for most grown-ups with kids, and mm-hmm. we should be asking our kids permission before we share their picture. It really sets them up for understanding how social media works, sets them up for having great boundaries themselves, and I think 8 or 9 is a good time to start asking permission, unless your child is demanding privacy sooner, in which right. case I would respect that, absolutely.
But before that time, you're saying, I mean, you splash the family pictures up on Facebook, but starting at that age, you say, hey, is this all right with you?
Exactly, and even before that time, I would use some discretion about what you share, you know, even when your child is a toddler or a preschooler. Think about the fact that they will very soon be a more self-aware, self-conscious 12 or 13-year-old, and how will they feel about this particular image that you've shared? And if you're not sure, you may not want to share it.
Devorah Heitner is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. So here again, you're talking about parental Facebook use and asking the kids permission to put their pictures on starting at age 8. And there is a fair amount of back and forth in the book. In fact, the first list of rules in here is really what kids want for their parents and devices. Tell more about that.
Well, they're very observant about the way we use technology, and that was one of the things when I started going into middle schools and doing workshops that really stunned me, is how closely they've been observing us. They're very aware, and so they don't want us texting and driving, and they also would prefer that we didn't use them as their secretary. I mean, it's certainly safer to have your child text while you drive, but they don't really love it, and it's something apparently a lot of parents are asking kids to do, because I've heard this from kids all over the country when I'm doing workshops, that parents are either texting and driving themselves or asking their children to text and drive, which just suggests that we're all a bit more stressed out. I mean, we all used to get in the car and we would not be in communication with anyone who wasn't in the car, and that was acceptable for many, many years, and now there's this sense that we have to be sort of simultaneously in the car with the people in the car and also communicating with other people. And I think we all need to check in and dial back that stress. And the other thing the kids really notice is that their parents are less attentive to them when we're on our own devices. And my own child has absolutely let me know that even if I look up from my laptop, I'm not really listening to him unless I actually close it and put it away. And he's not wrong.
Yeah, so he's already in tune with the whole alone together phenomenon that you write about in the book, where we're all there in the same space, but we're not really with each other.
Absolutely, and Sherry Turkle wrote a book by that title, which is also a great book on this subject, and I think families need to pay attention to how frequently we're alone together. I think spouses in bed next to one another who are both on their own devices are, you know, not necessarily having the most connected marital moment. And it may be that there are some times where that works for the family, but if you look around and see that frequently everyone's head is down and onto their own device, that could be an issue.
So let's move on to some concerns expressed by you and other experts who work in this general realm of knowledge. Compensating for the lack of visual cues in online communication is a big one. Understanding norms and etiquette in different platforms and balancing accountability with security. That first one is really interesting, the lack of visual cues in online communications, which I suppose is why emojis got so popular.
And the kids love emojis, and they feel like that solves the problem for them. But in fact, another boy said something very deep to me. I was at a rural school, and these kids were lovely and sweet, and they're all out on the farm every day, but they're also all texting and using social media, right? And I asked them, what are some of the challenges with texting? And he said, well, sometimes when you text, you forget to be nice.
Huh.
And I thought, well, that's really true. It's very easy for me to text my husband, pick up the cat litter instead of, hi, honey, you know, if the traffic isn't too bad, we'd really love it if you could grab some cat litter. Right? And it doesn't take that much longer, but it's easy to forget. And it's also easy to mishear or misread someone's text. So for a kid to get a text from another friend that says, where were you at lunch? It's very easy to read that as an accusation. You know, where were you at lunch?
Mm-hmm.
Opposed to just, I would love to have lunch with you. You know, can we meet for lunch? Right? And it just sounds... It sounds very accusatory. Read a certain, there's no cues there. There's nothing, you don't get my facial expression or my vocal tone to help you understand what I might have meant.
Mm-hmm. And the emojis will cover some of the ground there if you can put a little smiley face next to it. And it certainly goes far beyond smiley faces now. Understanding norms and etiquette in different platforms, do you have to be different on Facebook than you'd be as a texter or in Snapchat or something?
I think that we do, and texting has conditioned us all to expect very quick responses, for example, and then people take that into email and expect that someone will respond right away in email, and people are emailing a bit more and more. The norms of emailing are becoming a bit like texting. I don't know if you've seen this in your email, but it's becoming more typical in the longer exchange to drop salutations and other
right.
things in email. And we just need to teach kids to pay attention. For example, if you're emailing out about a prospective job or a high school scholarship or a summer program, you wouldn't open that email with a hey. That's a bit too informal for an email in that situation. Maybe to your best friend you might hey them, but it's very important that kids understand those different conventions. Or, you know, Twitter has a very different convention because we're speaking a little bit more publicly on Twitter than we are in some of our more personal social networks, like Instagram might be more informal, Pinterest might be a little bit more domestic and homey. And kids pick those up, but it takes a little bit of time. And I think the conventions of some social media and texting can rub off on others.
Right.
And then you could be up for quite a challenge, especially if you're texting across the generations. You know, when I was teaching college, I had quite a number of college students text me as the professor as hey, which was a bit, again, too informal for that
right.
scenario.
Devorah Heitner, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is the founder of Raising Digital Natives, which is dedicated to assisting parents and schools help kids navigate the world of digital connectedness. She's written a book called Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you've had some experiences of your own with young people and digital devices, or trying to come to grips with your own use of it as seen by young people. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go first to Misha in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
I have a little bit different take on that. That Jean Piaget mentioned that children, preschool kids particularly, learn differently. They learn through play, through social play, and that's what they really need. Pretend play where their ideas become important, and that's not what the kids need is to they have and the other thing is that computer, it seems like these kind of things like people are becoming like computer speak, because for example, like now, Jeff, like people say things like no problem.
Uh-huh.
It's like people to computer speak, or on the bus, people on the bus, and everybody's emailing. Everybody's people could be talking to one another. There was a movie that you might have seen years ago that was about somebody was driving a bus, and he had a theater group, and the people were involved. They were involved for one another, and the thing about it is that I really think that these kind of things isn't really helping people. It's making people become maybe in a hurry and not in tune with one another.
All right. Thanks for that, Misha. Appreciate it. Thoughts from you, Devorah?
Yeah, well, I absolutely agree with some of these concerns. I think they're shared widely by other members of our human community. And the question is, how can we use technology to make us more human and more connected and not use it to dissociate? And that's something as adults we need to model for kids, that we don't want to be looking down at our screens at every moment. It's actually more stressful to check your email 50 times a day and doesn't accomplish anything. If you're not in a position to actually answer a complex communication, you don't want to be checking it. So if you're, you know, two people from the front of the line at the bank, that's not actually a great time to download your email and get an intense communication from someone that you then need to respond to at length, because you're not going to be able to, and it's just going to stress you. With early childhood and technology, I'm a believer in very high quality media for young children. I do think that it can extend some of their interests, but the best technology for young children extends those interests in pretend play and extends their interpersonal communication, but we know it's not a substitute. And clearly, I mean, if I had to choose, you know, a childhood, you know, without crayons and blocks, or a childhood without an iPad, I would definitely choose the childhood without an iPad, because I think the childhood without crayons or blocks would be poorer. That said, I've seen amazing uses in preschool. Just doing things like documenting kids' block buildings, kids get real hesitant to take them down, right? They, mm-hmm. They build something beautiful. Great, let's document it, take a picture of it, and then you can take it down and create something else. But just that simple use of photography in an early childhood setting can be really lovely for kids and can extend their experience of something that's very, very rich, which is playing with blocks.
Oh, that's interesting. Ways to use the electronics to support what's happening in the physical world.
Exactly.
ScreenWise is the book, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Here's another call from Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. Good morning. I think it's such an important topic. It's the only one that I've been woken up to recently. I read a book called Breaking the Trance. It's just out. And it talks about screen dependency. And I realized it in myself as I was reading this book about children. And it says that, and I wonder if you guests could comment on this, that, well, first of all, the companies design the games to hook the children in, and they do it by overclocking their minds. They say that people think about it about 600 words a minute, and they make their games as 1,000 words a minute you have to think at. And then they frustrate you. They give you... You gain in a game or something, you win, but then you get frustrated and you lose, and it keeps you coming back for more, and this makes a whole adrenaline rush in the system. It's like scientific evidence about this, and that keeps them hooked. And the other thing is that the screen dependency interrupts, according to this book, Breaking the Trance, interrupts moral development and identity development if it's overdone. This book doesn't say you should never use it, mm-hmm. but that you really need to have a plan and limitations. Otherwise, you get dependent on it, and it actually changes your brain and interrupts the moral and identity development of teenagers.
All right, let's get some thoughts here from DeVore.
Yeah.
Thanks for
Absolutely.
That, Vajra.
Absolutely. I think moral and identity development are crucial parts of being a teenager, and we don't want our kids crowdsourcing their identity from social media. But social media, Tumblr, blogs can all be places where kids are actually working out their identity and expressing their identity. I do think it's important for kids to have a literacy in the fact that social media is partly a performed identity, just like we as adults have to remember when we see everyone sharing their awesome vacations or their perfect family moments, that's an edited version of their reality. And
I love that phrase, performed identity.
It's huge, and we're actually trying to teach kids to do it. When we try to teach kids not to share things we don't want them to share, we're teaching them to perform, right? We're saying, hey, don't share that. That's bad digital citizenship, but share this. This is positive, and it will make colleges want you. And in a sense, we're teaching kids to perform a certain aspects of their identity that are more palatable and that we want to be more public and that will benefit them. But we all need to understand that social media, it doesn't give us a full picture of who someone is, right? That we all know different aspects of our close friends that they're not sharing on Facebook or on Twitter or on Instagram, but that are still very crucial to who they are and why we love them. So I think in terms of identity, it's very important for kids to learn a balance between performing in that space and who they really are. In terms of moral identity, I'm less worried than that book sounds like it is. I mean, I think most kids want to be amazing friends, and I tend to harness that conversation when I talk with kids, when I work with kids. I ask them to think about, well, what does a good friend do when they're playing a game? Who's someone you would want to play with? Or what's a good friend on social media? And when do we need to go beyond the screen? When, if we see someone that's really hurting, when do we need to go past the emojis and past the "you're beautiful" and "I love you" on Instagram and move into, hey, I need to reach out to an adult in the community because my friend is really expressing a mental health trauma, or I need to at least go see them in person and assess how I think they're doing and be there for them in a real way, in a face-to-face way. So I think we want to raise kids who know when to go beyond the screen in their relationships. And then that question of the way devices are designed to bring us back,
mm-hmm.
I think that's very real, and we need to teach kids to be able to understand that and resist that, but also to not feel that they've had a moral shortcoming when they get distracted by devices.
Not to have not a moral shortcoming. Okay, we'll explore that in just a moment here. Devorah Heitner is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. We'll resume the conversation and bring you into it with phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Devorah Heitner, who is the founder and director of Raising Digital Natives. The name is quite straightforward. It's about raising children in a time when they have grown up with electronic devices always around them and the internet always accessible to them. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about her book, Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone, or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to explore what you're just talking about, though, about kids getting lost in screens. You want to make them realize that's not about a moral failing?
Exactly. So, I mean, the caller was asking about design, and it's true. These apps are designed to keep us immersed and to keep us checking, keep us playing, keep us attending to them. That is what designers are going for. So we can teach kids to resist that, to question that, to keep their devices in a different part of the house that they're not always in, to consider whether double screening is a great plan when they're doing their homework, because a lot of kids have multiple devices out and they're doing their homework maybe on a laptop or a Chromebook or an iPad, and then they have another device like a phone or another tablet, you know, right next to them, and that can be very distracting. It can be hard to work. But we don't want to tell kids, hey, there's something wrong with you because you're so immersed. So I think that's the message a lot of kids get from adults or even their teachers or their parents. And there's nothing wrong with us. We're all in the same boat. Adults sit down to do their work and get distracted by social media too, or get distracted by checking the sports score or
get stuck in a good book, you know.
Exactly. But I think because we're doing it all at the same place and our computers are the sites of so many different enticing opportunities, that might be more fun than our work. It's not surprising that that happens. So we want to teach kids strategies for dealing with it, but we don't want to teach them that they are bad, you know, which is, again, this message. And so many adults are so distracted, and then they're like, what's wrong with my kid? He's so distracted. So it's very important that we don't shame kids for using technology or being distracted by it, but that we say, hey, this app is designed to make you feel immersed, but we also need to eat dinner. So what's a strategy? And ideally, as a parent, we want to co-create solutions with our kids and say, let's come up with a strategy together that will help you transition from the game or transition from the app into eating dinner with the family or into doing your homework and be able to focus on one thing at a time. But we have to stretch those muscles. You know, in other periods in human history, we were stretching our farming muscles or our hunting muscles, and now we're stretching our attention muscles and really learning how to make those transitions.
I want to get into the realm of privacy and security, though, because this is always a big one for young. It's really a big one for anybody who spends any amount of time online. And I just wonder how differently, in general, digital natives view the very concept of privacy. I mean, one of the foster kids, when he got his first paycheck, put the whole thing in a picture on Facebook. And I said, you know, you really don't do that. It's not cool in the real world, and it shouldn't be in the cyber world.
Exactly, but they do want privacy, but often the people they want privacy from are us. They want privacy from mom and dad. They want privacy from the educators that work with them. They don't really understand, for example, why someone in their professional life would look at their personal social media. Often that's kind of a, there's a disconnect there because they feel like, well, this social media stuff is for my friends or my gaming persona is for friends. And so they're not thinking about the ways that those communities can overlap. And frankly, even adults find this tricky. I've seen many adults sharing things about colleagues and work that they really shouldn't share on social media, even if they're not directly connected with people from work on social media. You're making yourself very vulnerable to share, for example, criticism of colleagues or something that happened at work. That's not a great idea to share that on social media, but people do it all the time. And so, we shouldn't be surprised that kids are making those errors. They also may not really know about identity theft. Like your foster child sounds like he might not have thought about the ways that someone could use the information that's on a check to potentially take advantage of him financially. And that's a huge literacy that we need to teach kids. And frankly, I mean, who among us learned about identity theft growing up? It was not something I was worried about as a kid. And I don't think it was as much on people's radar what you could accomplish with someone's identity. But in this age of digital banking, of course, you don't want someone taking out a credit card in your child's name and all of these other vulnerabilities. So we need to teach kids about it, but we shouldn't be shocked that their ideas of what's private are different. And I think post 9/11, the norms of privacy. So, you know, as a Gen Xer, I believe that the books I take out of the library, that's private. And, you know, why should anyone know? Certainly no one should open my mail. That's private. Why should anyone scan my email in a workplace? That's private. I have those beliefs quite strongly. But when I talk to kids in school today, kids who are in high school or middle school, they talk about safety. And they say things like, well, it's more important to be safe than private, and I'm not doing anything wrong anyway, so it's okay, for example, if the government looks at my social media or knows what library books I took out, because it's more important to be safe. And that is a very different sensibility, but I think we have to understand it as a generational difference, and I think it's a post-9/11 kind of difference. Mm-hmm. It worries me a little bit as an older person what this means for us. I think these kinds of privacy are very important for citizens to have, but instead of being alienated from younger people, I think we have to just have conversations with them, understand what they mean by privacy, and see, you know, where we net out in the end. But we have to get curious about kids. I think, again, rejecting their sensibilities about anything, privacy, social media, it doesn't make sense to just reject. We have to be curious.
We have to explore it instead of just, yeah, blow it off completely. I'm curious about the cyberbullying and how big a concern that is for kids today, if it's like a worse fear than getting pounded by somebody in the hall in front of your locker.
It can be more public than that, and it can and extend beyond that. It's often in concert with that. Most kids who are being cyberbullied are also being what we would consider, you know, traditional bullying. You know, kids are being socially isolated in some way or being treated in a cruel way by a peer or group of peers. So true cyberbullying is rarely something that just crops up on its own. There's a lot of relational aggression that can come up both in person and on social media, and that's something that isn't necessarily cyberbullying. So when it's a back and forth exchange of negative text messages between two kids who have relatively equal social power, a lot of people will call that cyberbullying, but it's really just aggression, and we don't like it. And social media, because it's so recordable, kids can bring screenshots to school or show them to their parents. It's showing us a lot of icky behaviors that as adults we might be shocked by, but they're not necessarily new behaviors. It's just that the digital world, because we can record incidents on video, because we can see things on social media and screenshot them, it makes these behaviors much more visible to adults and creates an ethical dilemma sometimes. Is this something that the school should deal with? Is this a parent's issue? Is this a police issue? So a lot of challenges interpersonally between young people become something that adults are adjudicating, whereas in previous generations, many times adults weren't even aware of how negative the interactions were between kids.
Let's take a call here. We have Gretchen and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Devorah Heitner, the author of Screenwise.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is going back to preschoolers and really young people using devices, and I want to respectfully disagree and suggest, there are schools. My son goes to a school where there are no devices. And the research shows that once they get to high school, this is a first through eighth grade school, all those children catch up so quickly. They have no problem, so that the positive sides of using devices and what their world's going to be is not compromised. But by not using those devices as young children, they're allowed to be children all the way and not be distracted and have their brains grow in a really different way. And so that's my question.
All right,
having you comment on that.
All right. Thanks, Gretchen. Appreciate it.
Well, I think that my philosophy doesn't necessarily disagree with that. I think that families should choose the environment that they think is correct for their own kids. And if that's the environment that your child is thriving in, it's not a negative thing. I do believe that learning some experience of being in a digital community prior to high school can be really helpful for kids. So, for example, being in a blog in your third grade class and learning to navigate blog comments from other students and figuring out how to deal with that while you're in a face-to-face accountable situation. In other words, many of us dove into public, you know, social media at a very public level, and then we're dealing with people that we don't know following us, right? Like when I'm on Twitter, there are plenty of people following me on Twitter that I don't know, so I'm not face-to-face accountable with them. Whereas if I'm in a blog community in my elementary or middle school, I do have a degree of face-to-face accountability. So if, say, I make a blog comment that offends one of my classmates, I have to deal with that in a very personal way, and I have the teacher there to mentor me. So I think what we want to be careful of not doing is throwing kids into the deep end with nothing. But the caller is absolutely correct that kids will pick up, teenagers, for example, can pick up using a laptop or a tablet, no problem, in high school. So I don't feel like a child who hasn't learned how to do that is going to be at some kind of lifelong disadvantage. I do think that there are some pluses to using tech. I think the better the teacher is at leading that technology to, the better. I think just throwing a bunch of tech at kids at young ages when it's not skillfully taught, when it's not being used to extend the learning, when it's not being used productively, is not very helpful. The best schools that are using technology with young kids are doing it in a very intentional, very thoughtful way. And same thing with families, just giving your kid your smartphone doesn't give them any advantages. It might shut them up for a minute so you can eat your meal, but it might not actually teach them the self-regulation that you want to teach them. You might want them to learn self-regulation in a restaurant so that you can take them to restaurants. So it may not be, you know, long-term the setting them up the way you would hope, but it might, you know, accomplish just a short-term goal. But if you're working with your child, showing them how you use technology to communicate and showing them when technology won't do, when you actually need a face-to-face, for example, if you're in an argument and you teach your kids, okay, well, we can't resolve this on text, so we're going to have to face-to-face have a conversation so we can work it out and really listen and hear each other, I think that's really, really positive. So technology is with us. It's part of our lives, and we want our kids to get those competencies. But I do think it's up to individual parents to make choices about when to introduce specific technologies to their child. And if your kid is getting technology at school and it makes you uncomfortable, and a lot of families are in that situation where they might feel like they want their child to be a little more unplugged and their school is going one-to-one, so what do you do at that point? Then you really want to collaborate with school and deeply understand what is their plan, what are they actually doing. A lot of times parents assume that one-to-one technology means their kids will be on a device 24/7, and most school districts, that's not their plan. So it's good to find out a little bit more about what school is doing with tech as well.
Well, there's a really interesting concept you cite in the book, the idea that kids create content willingly all the time through the net versus, for example, writing papers that only the teacher will read, which doesn't really thrill them. And so how, for example, do you bring these worlds together to encourage a kid to learn?
There's some great ways to get kids excited about creating content and sharing it. So, yeah, that idea that I share in the book about authentic audiences, that kids are more excited, and some kids will get very excited to create a movie or write an essay when they know that their global writing partner in Brazil is going to be reading it, for example, or that they're going to get to read to some elementary school students in another time zone or another community. It's very motivating, and so I think, the skillful teachers out there are harnessing those kinds of experiences to get their kids excited about the work that they're doing. And it's great for kids to be able to have an experience of a positive digital footprint. We get so excited, worried that kids will share the wrong things. But what happens when you do share a movie or a podcast that other people respond to? We want to teach kids that this is a way to get your ideas across. There are a lot of big problems in the world right now, and we want to teach kids to think about being problem solvers. So whether that's designing apps to solve problems or even using funding platforms online to fund solutions, that's something that kids can learn how to do. And when they see other kids working positively in the digital world to create good changes in their local communities, nationally, internationally, that's very inspiring for kids.
We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to ask about the essentially, you give homework in the book. Parents really need to assess their own digital literacy, don't they?
Absolutely. We all need to ask ourselves hard questions about, am I modeling a positive use of technology? Is there a way that my relationship with technology could change in a way that would help my family life or just even help my own mental health? And I think all of those things are really positive. I think getting ScreenWise is a process.
It truly is, and ScreenWise is the name of Devorah Heitner's book, ScreenWise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. She is the founder and director of Raising Digital Natives, and as that name implies, it's about raising kids in an age where they have always been around electronics and constant internet connection. She guides us through it in the book and has joined us in this hour. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Heitner.
Thank you.
All right, take care.